Politics, I learned, has an ugly side that most people never fully appreciate. This realization instilled in me great respect for those willing to sacrifice much in order to serve. It also showed me that there are always going to be some people who are angry and hateful, and politics provides them a venue to vent their frustrations. You can't let that stop you from standing up for what you believe. As my granddad told my mother, "Carol, if you don't have somebody mad at you, you probably haven't done anything." My brothers and I attended public schools, participated in extracurricular activities, and played a variety of sports from baseball to basketball to tennis, with some sandlot football thrown in. We would get into fights every once in a while, as young brothers tend to do. Being close in age made us competitive, but it also made us close when we needed one another. Politics was something we each got involved with in school, too. Following the landmark 1971 Supreme Court ruling in Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg Board of Education, the Austin Independent School District was one of a number of cities nationwide under court order to use busing as a way to achieve school desegregation. White flight occurred in many parts of the nation after the ruling, including in Austin. From 1971 to 1972, a number of white families in Austin relocated to school districts neighboring the city. In 1972, my mother was one of three candidates elected to the Austin School Board who were opposed by a slate of anti-busing, some said pro-segregation, candidates. My mother won a seat on the board with 75% of the vote and still views with pride the way the school board peacefully and successfully integrated the schools during the 5 years she served. During my mother's time as a member, the board developed a sixth grade center plan as an initial step to desegregate the schools. Under the plan, students who had attended predominantly white neighborhood elementary schools were bused, along with students who attended heavily minority neighborhood schools, to a school between the two areas of Austin for their sixth grade year. My brothers and I were bused from our West Austin neighborhood, where kids attended Cassis Elementary School, to attend Baker's sixth grade center located in central Austin. Students from predominantly African American and Hispanic Ortega Elementary in East Austin were also bused to Baker. The school board did not believe this plan placed an undue burden on any one area by having kids from just a single neighborhood bused across town. Instead, students from both areas would be bused to an in-between point. I served as president of the student council at the Baker Sixth Grade Center. The school was diverse, quite a change from the neighborhood elementary school I had attended, which had only a small number of black and Hispanic students. I look back on my year at Baker with fondness. If there had been no busing, I might never have met Herman Hill, an African-American student who served as vice president of the student body. Despite hotly contesting my claim to being the better basketball player, Herman, more than 20 years later, agreed to be a member of my wedding party. At Baker, I also became friends with Heap Pham, a recent immigrant from Vietnam. Heap, a bright student who was still transitioning to English, used to refer to me affectionately as Chuck Norris, Chuck Norr, as he would say in his accent, and in response, I called Heap, a young black belt, Bruce Lee. I did not study karate, but Heap tried to teach me a few moves. The lessons did not stick. Before she lost interest in me, my smart, pretty sixth-grade girlfriend was Camille Mojica, a Hispanic girl. Such a relationship was considered unusual in those days. In favoring racial integration, I was carrying on a family legacy that extended back beyond my mom's school board service. During Granddad's tenure as dean of the University of Oklahoma Law School, he testified in the case of Ada Lois Scipiol Fisher, a black woman who was challenging the state's new segregated law school for black students, which was held in a small curtained-off area inside the Capitol building. The state had hastily opened the law school following the Supreme Court ruling in a previous case brought by Fisher that Oklahoma could not refuse to provide a legal education to all. Not surprisingly, she did not feel this was equal protection to which the 14th Amendment entitled her. Recalled former Texas law school professor and nationally renowned constitutional law expert Charles Allen Wright at a memorial service for my grandfather in 1999. She brought a new action in state court challenging the constitutionality of this instant law school. Called to testify by the attorney representing Fisher, future Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, my grandfather stated that there was no way that the new law school could be considered equal to the long-established University of Oklahoma Law School. As Wright also noted in his eulogy, Granddad testified calmly and rationally, but a younger colleague on the faculty at OU Law School, who also sided with Fisher, was more emotional and less restrained in his comments. The younger professor's testimony led vocal supporters of segregation in Oklahoma to demand that the university board fire him. As dean, my grandfather sent a letter to the chairman of the Board of Regents standing up for the professor's right to freely express his views, and pointing out, how the national reputation of the university would be hurt if it fired a professor for stating his honest view about segregation. Granddad's defense of the professor prevailed. The chairman of the board later told him that had it not been for his letter, the professor would have been dismissed. Granddad would become known over the years for hiring top professors with diverse viewpoints and loyally speaking up for their right to academic freedom when their comments created controversy. Upon returning as dean, Granddad oversaw the peaceful integration of the University of Texas School of Law following the Supreme Court decision in Sweat v. Painter, another landmark case that had been working its way through the legal system while Granddad was at OU. My whole family was proud of our patriarch's championing of equal rights and freedom of speech, and my own interest in public service owes a lot to his inspiration. Eventually, I served as president of my junior high student council and then as student council president of Austin High School, the same one my mother had been president of 29 years before. During my time as Austin High student body president, I came to befriend a colleague who was president at Johnston High School in Austin, John Barr. He too had grown up around politics. His father was a close friend and advisor to then-Congressman J.J. Jake Pickle, the longtime representative from Austin who succeeded Lyndon Baines Johnson in Congress. The year we came to know each other, my mother was running against Pickle. She lost. Over the years, John and I have talked about how, despite being in opposite political parties, our political views are pretty closely aligned. We have often discussed the dangers to democracy posed by each party's hardline, uncompromising ideological purist. In high school, I gave up all sports, save for tennis, and ended up becoming a top-ranked singles and doubles player. Our high school team ended up number two in the state my senior year. I did well in high school, graduating with honors in the top 20% of my class, but not as well as my older brothers, who finished as valedictorian, and salutatorian, beaten out by his twin. After briefly entertaining the idea of attending the U.S. Naval Academy and playing tennis there, I decided to stay home and attend the University of Texas. I joined the fraternity where two of my brothers were members and pursued a degree in government. The tennis coach, Dave Snyder, offered me a non-scholarship position on the top-ranked tennis team as well. Coming to the realization that my chances were slim for taking it to the next level, I ended up quitting the tennis team halfway through my sophomore year. Midway through my junior year, I was elected president of the 120-plus member Sigma Phi Epsilon chapter for a one-year term. Fraternities at the time were undergoing closer scrutiny from the university and county attorney over concerns about continued hazing. Hazing was part of the culture in the UT fraternity system, and the system had a long history of national notoriety. It wasn't an element of university culture that I felt comfortable with. During my freshman year, Mark Seeberger, a pledge in another fraternity, died of alcohol poisoning in a hazing incident. Later, I lost a childhood friend and all-around nice guy, Scott Phillips, who joined a fraternal organization and got caught up in a hazing incident that resulted in his death. While serving as a pledge trainer, he fell off a cliff while being chased through a park by a group of young pledges engaging in a bit of reverse hazing. Incidents like these made me and others at UT feel that the hazing culture needed to change. Nationally, SIGEP headquarters was working diligently to steer its chapters in a new, more positive direction. Such a change can be hard to bring about, but I would try, in part by necessity and in part by choice after a regrettable experience on my watch as the chapter's president. I had taken over my presidential responsibilities just before Christmas break of my junior year. We had returned to school, and as was the tradition, the fall pledge class was going through its unsanctioned hell week. This included sleep deprivation and mostly verbal hazing, but some physical hazing as well. Having experienced hazing as a pledge, I came to view it as a peculiar way to instill brotherly love. During this particular hell week, however, things got out of hand. One pledge suffered eye injuries in a moment of near exhaustion from lack of sleep late one night. It was a freakish accident. Hair dye from a crazy costume donned as part of the hazing ritual ran into his eyes, partially blinding him. One of my fraternity brothers brought him down to my room at the fraternity house. We immediately had him taken to the emergency room where he was treated and returned home early the next morning. At the time, doctors expressed concern that the eye injury could affect him for the rest of his life. Nevertheless, the pledge insisted he did not want to make an issue of what happened. I told him he needed to do what he felt was right, regardless of what it meant for others, but I also realized that the hazing problem was one our fraternity needed to deal with honestly and head-on, and that covering up an incident of this kind would not be constructive in the long run. After the volunteer alumnus chapter counselor and I discussed the matter, we agreed it was best to inform the chapter alumni board, which included lawyers who were rightly concerned about potential liability. I told the alumni I would accept responsibility for whatever needed to be done. They ultimately decided to handle things internally, but we all agreed that we had to end the hazing culture inside the fraternity once and for all. I stood up at chapter meetings and, in my role as president, strongly urged that Hell Week be eliminated in the future. This was a tough position for me to take. I was the one who had to bear the brunt of the criticism from fellow fraternity brothers who viewed hazing as something everyone does at UT and had done for a long time. They wondered why our chapter should change because of one incident involving a pledge who did not even hold the slightest grudge. The alumni board did little openly to back me. Perhaps understandably, they were squeamish about shouldering responsibility for this unpopular position. But despite being alone on this issue, I stuck to my guns. It cost me some friendships and created some vocal criticism. I held a firm line because I believed it needed to happen and it was the right thing to do. And some fraternity members joined with me. We effectively ended hazing within our fraternity, at least temporarily.